thank you everybody for coming, and a warm welcome to Rachel Aldred, who's a reader in transport at the University of Westminster, with particular expertise in cycling. She does lots of research on the safety of cycling and people's willingness to cycle, given their feelings about the safety of cycling in London. And in particular, she is winner of an ESRC prize for outstanding impact of her research in 2016. And that's part of the sort of topic that she's going to talk to us today about, research and policy change. We're very interested in evidence-based policy in the department, so we're super excited to have Rachel's talk. So over to you for, we have around 45 or 50 minutes for the talk, and then plenty of time for questions and discussion at the end.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. Thanks for inviting me. I realise the talk may be a bit more about the policy change than about the specific research, but I think we've got half an hour for discussion, so you know, if people want me to say more about the research or any aspects, then that's absolutely fine. I guess what I've... That's right, I'll use the mouse. I guess I'll start with the sort of problem that I've been really trying to investigate, I guess, for the past 8 years now, which is really to do with the problems we have in this country planning for cycling. So one of the pieces of work I'm involved in is called the Propensity to Cycle Tool, and we've just released some results about the really high potential for cycling across the country, really, particularly in compact urban centres, but across the country. So really big potential benefits we could get, health benefits, social benefits, environmental benefits, and so on. And yet, cycling is bumping along at this very, very low mode share, and there's only progress in a few areas. We want to get to this. Now, this is a slide that I love showing in my presentations, although when I don't have to anymore, I should probably be quite happy. This is the front cover of our Cycle Infrastructure Design Manual, our national design guidance. And one problem with it being that is not where we want to get to, in my view. So, but why are we still designing for and getting that when what we want, and we keep saying what we want, is that is the problem? So I'm going to talk a bit about some of the issues, some of the discourses, some of the practices, and some of the change that we've been seeing in London, some sort of, you know, limited and partial change, but very interesting change. And it's always exciting to study change as a researcher. And change in a positive direction is kind of unusual and particularly exciting. So there we go. So brief London chronology. People probably familiar with this, but I'll just go over it quickly. So in 2000, we had the Greater London Authority created. In London, we have a relatively high degree of devolution. And transport initially was the main thing that the authority and the mayor had control over. Now there's more stuff there, but initially it was mainly transport. In 2003, we had the London Congestion Charge introduced. And in the early 2000s, we had a lot of bus priority and pro-walking policies, largely. And we saw a really impressive modal shift away from the car. Central London road space allocated to private motor traffic was cut by 30% in those years, largely through bus lanes and pedestrian space. 2008... we saw the plan to build cycle superhighways first announced. In 2010, bike hire started. And in 2013, the publication of a document that was seen as quite significant called the Mayor's Vision for Cycling. And finally, last year, we saw the opening of the cycle superhighway north, south and east, west, which was rather nice because I could feature them in my ESRC impact video. So, yes, that's just an image from the front of the cycling vision document, but I'll come back to that later. This is some images from the cycle superhighway for people who haven't seen it. The east-west cycle superhighway taken from a blog. So at the top you can see Upper Thames Street before and Upper Thames Street afterwards. This just gives you a bit of a flavour of it. Another few images. So this is the embankment before, part of the embankment after. Going into another part of Upper Thames Street before and Upper Thames Street after. So you can see the quality of the engineering, which is quite unusual in terms of cycling in the UK. Just another one there that shows you people coming back from the sky ride, actually, on the top there, walking on the pavement with their kids, and on the bottom, what it now looks like in that area. So really some quite substantial change going on. Only a small part of London, only quite limited. Cycling is still low across London as a whole, but we've seen some really substantial changes lately. So I'm going to come back and say something about where we've come from and how we got into a situation that for many years across the country, and still is in many ways, is quite unpromising for cycling. So marginalising cycling here, that's just a kind of typical image, I guess, of what cycling in the UK can look like. And to give you a bit of context, so we've seen, in the context of the post-war years, we've seen a really substantial modal shift towards the car. I think it's really important to place cycling and any transport policy in the context of us having gone really quite quickly from a multimodal society back in the early 50s, where distance travelled by different modes was in the same ballpark, to a situation where the vast, vast amount of distance travelled is by car, plus we're travelling a lot further than we used to. Now, on that graph, you can't really see what's happening to cycling, except you can see in 1952, distance travelled by bike was really not that different from distance travelled by car, which is interesting, given cycling is kind of inherently a shorter distance mode. Okay. There we go. So that actually is what happened to cycling in those years. And you can see it's a bit more close up. And when I first started studying this area, it was really, I think I'd assumed cycling was had been on a steady decline. I think many people often do. But actually it fell off a cliff in the 1950s. And since then, and even since that as well, it's kind of been bumping along, really, not changing all that much, although that covers very big differences in different parts of the country in terms of the trend. But really, massive decline in cycling. If our policy goal had been to eradicate cycling in 1952, mm-hmm. then we'd have been feeling pretty pleased with ourselves by 1972, I think. So this didn't just happen. People may be familiar with this image. This is Traffic in Towns, the Buchanan Report from the early 60s, really worth a read, and was so popular. Most transport planning books are not issued as, you know, special paperback specials available at a cheap price to the general public. This was. And this image just illustrative in the early 60s, when cycling levels were still relatively high. You see, this is what Tottenham Court Road was going to look like. You've got lots of space for cars, you've got buses, this is London, you've got pedestrian space above, and just for anyone with poor eyesight, there is the cyclist. Buchanan incidentally said in Traffic in Towns, it would be lovely to have cycle tracks everywhere, but it would be implausible and too expensive, which, given that you're just considering knocking down Tottenham Court Road and building that, is kind of interesting. But this is the theme that continues. Cycling was in the post-war years, cycling was really not seen at all within transport policy, and it was really invisible for decades, as was walking. They just were not seen as part of mainstream transport policy. So in the 50s, there were debates about closing rail lines, there were debates about the cost of buses, there was no debate about cycling and what might happen about cycling. And these themes have kind of continued, and part of the problem we have with cycling is these discourses, these ways of thinking about cycling that are then embedded on the ground, very literally, and also in images, documents, and so on. And cycling, a continuing theme is that cycling is a local thing, it's kind of optional, it's certainly not strategic like the M25, we can see there. It's something that's a cheap option, walking and cycling are cheap options, they're also not prestigious, they're not seen historically as big infrastructure projects that you get points for, you know, you're opening £1 billion tram network, you're opening the M25. They're not seen as big, sexy projects. And I think one of the things that I found that was really interesting and really quite a block to thinking about cycling at all differently was that it was so individualised. In those post-war years, it wasn't part of public debate. It wasn't part of discussions about transport policy, which, you know, were raging pretty highly in the 1960s. We talk about what the car was doing to town centres. But cycling was not part of these debates. Even when it was starting to be seen as a good thing in the 90s, it was still seen as primarily an individual responsibility. And that has long roots from the period in the 50s and 60s where it just wasn't seen at all. It then became part of policy, but very individualised, not seen as a public responsibility, but seen as something that was the responsibility of individuals. First of all, they were risky individuals who were causing problems by cycling, and then they were good individuals who were doing environmentally responsible things by cycling. But it wasn't part of, you know, a system of provision. And I could just give you an example of this. This is Bolton Council, kind of randomly chosen as I grew up there. And I always enjoy reading local authority pages about cycling. You kind of learn a lot from them. So I went to Bolton Council cycling pages, and it's lovely. It has a picture of something that isn't transport cycling. It talks about guided rides and cycle training, first of all. Now, for some reason, information about driving and public transport doesn't start with those kind of things. But for cycling, you should get trained. But this I always like. This is quite common in most local authorities. I was tempted to run it them all through Turnitin. commuting by bike. Cycling to work is a great way to lose weight and get fit, cut travel costs and congestion, all in a journey you've got to make anyway. It's true, but people going to that page probably already want to cycle. And then there's a kind of talk about how you might be worried about cycling in traffic, but hey, you can deal with it. So it's very individualised, and that really fascinated me, the way in which it was seen as an individual responsibility. Many of us are just, it had got kind of normalised that cycling was something like that, that was so individual compared to the way we talk about other modes. So I wanted to spend a little bit of time talking about safety, because as people will know, cycling safety and risk has become such a big part of the public debate. Interestingly, in relation to the individualisation, I remember Andrew Gilligan, when he was cycling commissioner, saying you can't nationalise risk, which was interesting because in one sense that's what has happened. But I'll sort of explain that. So what happened to risk in those post-war years? First of all, one point to make that's really important is that we expect risk on the roads to go down. The risk of death, for one thing, goes down because healthcare improves. We get better at treating people who are very seriously injured. But also, risks, you generally expect a secular trend towards the roads getting safer. And this is generally what happened. This is road deaths per billion vehicle kilometres. So this is a broad picture of your risk of getting killed on the roads for each kilometre, largely driven. and you can see, it's okay, there are bumps, but you can see it's largely declining from 1949 to 2009. And, it's a fraction. By 2009, it's really a fraction of what it was in 1949. And that's normal. That's what you expect to see in a highly motorised society. This is what happened for cycling. And here, billion vehicle miles means miles cycled. So this is your risk of being killed per, for cycling, say, 3 miles, and how that changed. And in 1950... you can see it increases sharply to 1970, at which point, if you're doing your usual commute to work, you're 3 times more likely to be killed than in 1950. This is extraordinary. This is not a usual picture for risk on the roads. And then it sort of starts to decline. But even by 2010, it's not that much better than in 1950. And I think this is really instructive in terms of what happened to how we looked after people on the roads, and we looked after motorists an awful lot better than we looked after cyclists. We can't do the same graph for pedestrians because we have such poor data on walking, but I imagine that given that we think people stopped walking at quite a precipitous rate too, that you might see similar trends. We looked after the motorists and we failed to look after people using active modes. And so how is this responded to? Just to say as well that people feel, the perception of safety on the roads also has got a lot worse. People don't feel safe, which is really the important thing in terms of people thinking about cycling or not. And this, I said earlier that policy around cycling was individualised, and so historically has thinking about risk and cycling. And in the 50s, 60s, 70s and 80s, risk was the main way in which cycling was thought about. Cycling was a risk problem. So cycling, as I was saying, cycling has tended to be seen as an individual choice or responsibility. And cycling, rather than drivers or roads, has been seen as in itself dangerous. Somebody cycles, they are doing something dangerous, they are putting themselves at risk. And there has been this focus on individual solutions, which I'm sure people are familiar with. Safety clothing, for example, but also training. So in getting the individual cyclists to act differently to make themselves safer. And I would say it's also associated with stigma and blaming of cyclists, because the individual is responsible, the individual is meant to protect him or herself, and, wear stuff, to have training, to be in the right place, to be following all the rules, and so on. Very much a focus on individual cyclist behaviour. This it's very much part of a broader road safety paradigm that I find very problematic. So this is, I did some lovely archive research looking at some of this stuff. So this is a book from the early 60s telling children that if you ride without your hands on the handlebars, you deserve to be squashed by a bus. If you ride fast down a hill, none of us would ever do that, would we? If you ride fast down a hill and there's somebody driving around the corner who drives into you, that too is your own fault. The whole, there's 10 of these. Some of them deal with walking, some of them deal with cycling. You all have the children doing classic child behaviour and being killed in response. There we go. We don't like children. A more positive reaction, though, was to train children so they would become better cyclists. So this is the positive side of the individualisation. We saw in the 1950s there was a massive expansion of cycle training. I was interested to find this, and it was led by the bike companies. So the Rally School of Cycle Riding, the Silver Knights Association, all these kind of things set up. And there was this narrative about, hey, our children don't cycle, this is terrible. We are adults, obviously we drive, but our kids don't cycle, this is terrible. They're inside, they should be outside doing healthy things. The media says, at the bottom it says, the media says cycling is too dangerous, you know, we need to train our children so they'll be confident so they'll go out and cycle. And it's so similar to discourses that we see today. This one was nice. This is the proficient cyclist roadsmanship for young riders. And part of the argument around training the kids as well, interestingly, was that then they would be better car drivers when they grew up and inevitably left their bicycle behind and got a car. I think it's a deficiency model, really, of cycling. An example here, this I love, this sounded like some wonderful song. Their machines give them almost no protection. This is from a consultation paper from 1980. The Conservative government then launched a consultation on cycling. Cycling's a problem, there's too many deaths, what are we going to do about cycling? And there's nothing in it about promoting cycling, it's all about dealing with the risk aspect. And they say, cyclists are exposed and vulnerable, bicycles are not so stable as cars. Where cyclists are involved in accidents, their machines give them almost no protection. And it's this lovely deficiency model, you are not a car, you are deficient. What can you do that you will be safer, given that you are not a car and therefore you're a problem on the roads? This is another nice example as well. In 1984, I don't know if anyone has been to the annual Velo City conferences that
have organised it.
Ah, fantastic. So this is Velo City from 1984, and this is some adverts that were being demonstrated as part of London's contribution, what London was doing for cycling. And this is an advertising campaign, including the statement, cyclists, will your next right turn take you to the hospital? I'm not quite sure what the Dutch would have made of it. Maybe, I don't know. You know what the Dutch made of it?
Lots. They'd probably have left turn, but no.
Sure. So this is the kind of the approach of telling people you will not be safe cycling. You need to do stuff about it. I particularly like the way that drivers, now the nights are drawing in, it's even harder to see cyclists. This kind of discourse of it's really hard to see cyclists, they're a problem, they're difficult to see, and combined with the marginalisation of cycling, I think is quite problematic. So, we have cycle planning that marginalises cycling. So a few relatively recent examples, but just to say that This is a Dutch perspective on cycling in England. I think we got into this kind of vicious circle. Don't know if anyone recognises themselves there. Vicious circle where individuals are urged to wear personal protective equipment. You will not be seen. Wear yellow. Do all this stuff. And that kind of reinforces cycling being seen as risky. You know, if I was stood here wearing a helmet, you'd probably be looking a bit nervously at the roof, right? Cycling is then seen as being for risk takers. Those people who cycle, they obviously like taking risks. Cycling then attracts risk-tolerant groups, people who are more able to cope with this kind of thing. Planners then assume cyclists are all risk takers, and we kind of get this vicious circle. And it's also, it's a very gendered image and so on of cyclists, and there's some interesting work being done on that. We get into this sort of vicious circle. This is a lovely example. I wrote an article about this topic that was 8,000 words, but this person managed to put it in a cartoon. These competing images of cycling stigma. So on the one hand, cyclists are seen as those people who are doing something inappropriate on the road, getting in the way, they're not really doing proper transport, they're probably not even really going anywhere. And on the other hand, people who can't afford a car and bike to work, which in large parts of the country is still quite a strong stereotype of people cycling, actually including out to London, less so in central and inner London. These competing stigmas, cycling as being you've got no choice, or you're risk-taking, thrill-seeking, and even the images of cycling that you would think of as positive, that it's an environmentally friendly thing, becomes like you're an eco-fascist, you seek to impose your views on other people. And it's really, I remember talking to a group of people in Sweden, in Lund University, and it was a group of Danish and Swedish people. I tried to explain some of this and this kind of discourse and like the mammal stigma and all that, and they sort of really bemused. They said, "But why would people think that about someone who's keeping themselves healthier and saving costs on the health service and so on and so on?" And I'm like, "Look, you have to see it." They found it really hard to comprehend. And in policy documents, so this is from 2010, so the first Boris Johnson term, Cycling Revolution London, a planning document, and that's sort of like the image, the guiding image of it, and very much this construction, particular, okay, it doesn't have, you don't have the high vis and stuff, but you have, you know, the fast rider on a particular type of bike with a bus going one way, a van going the other way. It's constructing a particular image of cycling for particular types of people. And designs, the way in which we design infrastructure has, you know, often even when people were trying to build with, you know, quite good bike infrastructure, this is former Cycle Superhighway 2. It's better, it's improved since they upgraded it, but that was a classic sort of junction on Cycle Superhighway 2. And the assumption is those people are quite happy. They're happy cycling with the traffic. They just maybe want a blue strip to sort of tell them where they're going, and this is fine. This is the fast commuter. TfL actually, in one document I remember, referred to the hardened commuter, which I quite liked, because it suggested you'd grown an exoskeleton, perhaps. This is a junction on a original junction on the former Cycle Superhighway 2. That was basically what it was, a load of blue paint. On the one hand, you have this image of the risk-taking commuter. On the other hand, you have cycling as leisure, which obviously became very big in the post-war years. People stopped cycling for transport, but they started cycling for leisure, and there were BMXs, mountain bikes, and various different crazes. So we also have the image of the leisure cyclist, who doesn't mind very slow progress. They're probably not trying to get anywhere, really, so they don't really mind if they don't end up on a high street. They're just trying to go for a ride. They don't mind it being dark. They don't mind mud. They don't, you know... And this, my route to work used to be a little bit like that one underneath, not quite as crazy, but a little bit like that. And every few hundred yards, there would be these gates, there would be these obstructions, and it used to take you twice as long as it should have done to get to work. That one is a new piece of infrastructure. It assumes that somebody will be able to carry their bike or push it up that channel, which is actually is probably seen as a great improvement, but it's actually really quite tricky if you're disabled. It's going to be very, very difficult. So I think these discourses around what cycling is for fast commuters, it's for leisure riders, it's for people who have no choice, continue to shape what gets provided, and cycling continues to be marginalised. And then what there is out there on the street, on the road, then shapes interactions and reinforces some of these images. So to get onto something slightly more positive to finish off with. So something about this sort of started to change a few years ago, particularly in some of the discourse in London. And I'm just going to give a bit of a flavour of how that changed and why, some reasons why that changed. But just to contrast what I'm talking about. So this individualising response to risk, which focused very much on individual solutions and what individuals could do to protect themselves against danger on the roads. And then by comparison, what I would say is a kind of socialising paradigm, where cycling is seen, to some extent at least, as a public service or system. It's something that is provided for you, and if there's a problem, it is the authority, you know, in the first instance, the authority who is providing it needs to answer to that. Road design and or potentially other road users or road culture are seen as causing danger rather than individual cyclists themselves. And there's also more of a focus on collective solutions. So a little bit ago, that was really mainly in terms of infrastructure. There's some very interesting, I don't know if people have been following, developments in policing that are also, I think, fit within this, whereby for instance, the West Midlands Close Pass Initiative, where you have undercover officers cycling around and motorists being stopped for close passing them. So kind of solutions that don't focus on educating, training, you know, warning the individual cyclists, but actually focus on the environment in which they have to cope, with which they have to cope. And I think it's also associated with, holding politicians to account rather than blaming individuals, but saying, well, you know, why is it acceptable that somebody has a lapse of attention, might be a cyclist, might be a driver, and somebody dies as a result of that? How is that acceptable? It wouldn't be acceptable, in other contexts. So just to say something about how the discourse started to change and its impacts, and people may remember the media campaigns of the Times, but not only the Times, where we got, actually, the media started to take quite an interest in what was happening in terms of cycling injuries and deaths, and started to do some campaigning around it, partly due to the fact that what happened in London, we had some of the people who started taking up cycling were professionals working in the media as well, which I think meant that people, journalists in that situation, they might not cycle themselves, they probably knew somebody who cycled, and that maybe started to shape their interest and shape their perception of cycling injuries and cycling collisions and how you interpreted those. Were they an individual tragedy or were they something that was more systemic? This is from a paper that I contributed to where we looked at coverage of cyclist fatalities in the London Evening Standard. And so we're comparing cyclist fatalities to motorcyclist fatalities, the control to see if it was just more coverage of all deaths. And you can see that 1992 to 2004, and deaths are relatively stable. They went down a little bit. They didn't change that much. You're getting very relatively limited coverage. And then by the time you're getting to 2010, you're getting most cyclist deaths are being covered in the Evening Standard, whereas still only a minority of motorcyclist deaths are. And interestingly, this seemed to be this was London specific, partly because of the sheer numbers and the sheer size of London. Given the risk we get in this country, you've got a particular number of deaths, whereas somewhere like Birmingham, it's the second city, it's much smaller and you don't get this effect. But basically it meant that you were getting maybe 10, 12 cyclist deaths a year, getting coverage in the London Evening Standard and other papers, and people from Transport for London were being taken to those sites and being, had to look at those sites and think about what had happened there and what could be done to stop this happening in the future. Maybe we discuss this later. I just wanted to highlight one or two things that contributed to some of the prominence of this and some of the sort of challenges that happened around cycling safety in London. So this is one of the bloggers, cyclists in the city, a guy called Danny Williams, people, there's a kind of network of people on social media, and because I was researching this, it's quite interesting that I would be following these people and then I would meet them at events and people would say, oh, I'm such and such, I'm alternative DFT, I'm cyclists in the city or whatever, and you would meet people, and it was always generally interesting to see how people were in person compared to how they were on social media. But people, a way of spreading information, a way of sharing videos, links, consultation documents. Twitter is not very good for converting people to your viewpoint, but it is very good for sort of sharing information very quickly between people who are following each other. It was also social media as well provided a way for people working inside the system in transport planning organisations to communicate anonymously. There were people who wrote, who were in that position, who wrote about their experiences anonymously, who contributed anonymously. And there were certainly a lot of people in transport planning organisations who followed what was happening on social media and who took account of what people were saying. Data, just quickly, the way that people presented data and the fact that we have, in London particularly, but in the UK more broadly, we have quite good availability of transport data compared to many contexts. And this is from Transport for London. There are more recent figures now, but this was the one that was going around at the time. Was very powerful because you could kind of see that, obviously, public transport is very dominant, people coming into in central London, but car commuting back in 2000, 137,000 people coming in the peak by car, 12,000 by bike. So clearly the cyclists are the weird minority, as we, you know, it's per the whole tradition of cycling in this country in the post-war period. By 2011, that's 67,000 people coming in by car and 33,000 by bike. So you can see it's changed, it's started to change. If you present those figures like that, they look really quite, you know, they have quite an impact. But we know that cycling in London is very localised, that growth has been, you know, in particular areas. So there are large parts of London where you see very little cycling, but in these very visible contexts, particularly focusing on the commute going into inner London, central London, which has its problems to focus on that, but it's very visible. That had a big impact, and you saw people who were writing on social media. This is a graph that Danny Williams, who writes Cyclists in the City blog, presented, and this was just around the census, using the census data, it's a simple bar chart, just saying, look, actually, people who live in inner London, many of them now are cycling to work. In Hackney, there's more cycling than driving. In Islington, it's similar. And so being able to present this as being cycling is increasing, it needs to be provided for, which obviously is easier to do in a central inner London context than it is in some other contexts. To some extent, a lot of this policy change has really followed change in what people are doing. And the talk about peak car and people shifting away from the car, young people no longer aspiring to the car, that, in a sense, started happening before we got some of the policy and planning changes, which I think is interesting. Politicians always say they fear public opinion, but sometimes you sort of see the public, the way people are behaving, changes first. This one, again, this was interesting. Some of the research that Transport for London do is really, it's fantastic. This is a fairly simple survey. I've just been talking to some people about modelling cycling, but this is one of the reports that they do investment levels in cycling. So they ask people a question about, do you think too much, too little, or about right is being spent on cycling? And this is from 2012, and they've run it subsequently, and they found that, you know, it's people were much more likely to say too little was being spent on cycling than too much. Obviously, cyclists more likely, but also non-cyclists. And one interesting thing was that as it's kind of tailed off now, but initially, as investment in cycling went up, the proportion of people saying there's not enough money being spent went up as well, because in a sense it's established that we expect to spend large amounts of money on this, which had never been the case before. It became much more normalised. There was also some broader coalitions developed, and this, I haven't really got time to talk about it in detail, but you could compare it to the growth of the motor lobby in the 1950s and the way in which people networked, people learned from schemes, people went to visit the N6, the Preston bypass, the M6 and so on. Similar sort of things happening around cycling, it becoming seen as a growth area, something where young professionals could make their career, something where there were things to be learned, new things to be done. And this is a study that Transport for London sent people around to various cities across the world, and they came back with this best practice case study: do this, don't do this. Sort of a sense of networking, a sense of things changing, and also shifts in established organisations. People employed by TfL to work on cycling, which has increased massively. I can't remember the exact numbers off the top of my head, but certainly, you know, going from, well, something of the magnitude of 10, 20 to 200, those kind of changes, really quite dramatic. And an international coalition with researchers, practitioners, people kind of communicating at conferences and so on, and a growth in knowledge among planners as well. To give an example of how the discourse changed, this is an organisation called Londoners on Bikes that I did a bit of ethnographic research with back in 2012. And they were interesting because one of the problems cycling has faced is that, and walking, I guess, the assumption that there's not votes in it, that people are motorists, and that even in London, people are motorists, and that there's no votes in cycling. In fact, you'll probably just get yourself deselected or whatever if you support cycling. And so this organisation sort of say, vote with your bike and vote as a cyclist, which is quite an interesting strategy to take. And I went and observed some of their meetings and talked to some of them. And I thought it was really interesting sort of the way that people talked about this creation of a political issue around something that had been seen as an individual issue, and that links to the sort of it becoming a systemic thing. So just realising that it is a political question what the roads are like, that it's not just something that exists, that, you know, the roads are just like this, but actually it's something that is a choice and can be changed. And people being told that saying that being involved in this had given themselves a vocabulary, a manifestation of their views and being able to actually put it into practice. A lot of these people, interestingly, had come from other advocacy areas. They were not cycling advocates from previously, but they'd come from other areas, and they made links to other things, which I found really interesting. I think there's one, yes, this is a nice quote, from somebody who'd worked with young people, worked around peace initiatives, and she said, "Peace is not just this big thing for the UN to sort out, it's something that we live with day after day. I work with young people, so thinking about what peace means in London is something that I spend quite a bit of time on. So I started to think, well, there is this other space in which there is an absence of peace." So she drew from her other work. She says there's bits of the UN convention that are completely applicable to whether or not people can move around the city in the way they want to. And certainly that the state has a duty of care to actually protect citizens. And it's kind of responsible, like shifting responsibility. Very interesting. And TfL did a really nice report recently talking about the construction industry and the way that the construction industry takes responsibility for deaths at work. They have to, they've been made to, they can't get away with people dying on their site all the time, but they haven't been made to take responsibility for their trucks going out and killing pedestrians and cyclists on the roads. And just one, I guess, one example from my own research, I guess, which is sort of trying to think about the way in which the risk, cycling risk, that there's a whole kind of bogged down debate, I thought, about people on one hand say that, you know, cycling, I think the quote from the, is it in the Mayor's Vision for Cycling, in fact, I think, is that you would have to cycle every day on London's roads for 8,000 years before you got run over and killed. And so why aren't people cycling, you could say. So this kind of absolute, apparently very small risk, alongside many people saying cycling is terrifying, there was no way I would absolutely do it, I would ever do it. And this kind of gap, are people just irrational? Do they just need to be told, look, if you cycle for 8,000 years, you know, the health benefits and all this, and we know the health benefits. The health benefits across the population of uptaking cycling can be massive. The trade-off is not so good for some groups, though, because of the injury risk, but across the population, it will be massive. And anyway, I think, from a sort of sociological perspective, people are neither objective nor irrational, and that it is about that everyday experience, the way in which discourses, policies, practices create infrastructure, create the road environment, and the experience that people have of that road environment every day. And there is a modal hierarchy of people. I don't know, I live in Hackney, and we have a modal hierarchy in our transport planning documents. Pedestrians first, cyclists second, public transport, cars. And, you know, many authorities still have that, although Boris Johnson didn't like it. But if you actually ask people on, you know, research looking at how people perceive the streets, they will say the hierarchy is the other way around. They will say that motor traffic is prioritised and that pedestrians and cyclists are at the bottom. And that's what you learn on the streets. Whatever the transport, you know, the appendix of the transport plan says, that is what the conditions are like on the streets. So when the project that I did on near misses kind of uncovered some of those incidents that will never be recorded in everyday statistics, we don't even record the most slight injuries on the roads, but we, you know, many slight injuries on the roads, but things like everyday near misses, everyday almost collisions, those things that people experience every day that create an understanding of what cycling is like and also why many people don't want to cycle. I think that's just summarising what I've said around the individual socialising thing. I think I had a small section on inequalities in cycling, but would it be a good point to stop here and then see what, if we want to have a discussion, Q&A and...
I think, look, can you do the inequalities? Can you zip through the inequalities?
Oh, okay, great.
It's interesting, I think, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Sure. So this is something that I've become very interested in because all those discourses, those sort of problematic discourses and practices, they systematically exclude most people from cycling, but they systematically exclude some people more than others. And I think it's really important that this is seen as systemic as well because there has been this assumption it is only young men who want to cycle, and that is individualising it as well. It's saying only these groups who we currently see cycling are actually the people who want to cycle. I think it's important it's seen as a structural issue. Just to illustrate, I've just got a couple of quick slides to illustrate the gender and age gap in this country. So this is percentage of trips cycled, and this is commuting trips, and you can see that women are in red, women are below men, pretty much throughout, and cycling declines with age pretty dramatically for commuting for men, but also tends to decline generally. So it is in England, cycling is disproportionately something for men and disproportionately something for younger adults. Not so much for kids anymore. But this is a comparison, and this just shows you how different it could be. And so some of the work looking at other country contexts and illustrating how cycling, who cycles and what cycling looked like was different there, I think was really helpful in terms of thinking about how things can be different. They don't have to be as they are. It is not normal that women don't cycle. So this is the Netherlands. The interesting thing is often the line for women is above the line for men. So women cycling a higher proportion of their trips. And also that after an initial drop, cycling is then tending to increase back again with age, and to the extent that you've got women are in their 70s in the Netherlands do a quarter of their trips by bike. So that's not a quarter of women in their 70s in the Netherlands cycling everywhere. That's cycling being widespread among women in that age group in the Netherlands. But people, you know, many women in their 70s in this country would just not consider that was something that they would do. That would be possible for them. One reason for this is the infrastructure. It's a whole bundle of things together, but the infrastructure is really important. So I led a systematic review, it's published now, that looked at, there's a whole load of stated preference research in transport, which has its problems, but at least gets people to tell you what they would like. You know, what kind of environment they would like for riding or for walking or whatever it is, you know, what matters to them. So for cycling, a lot of this research focuses on infrastructure that keeps you away from motor traffic, because that's what people tend to say is important. So I did a systematic review of studies that covered that issue and that reported on whether there were gender differences. And I found a bit more than 50 studies were also reported on gender differences. They'd done a state of preference study, they'd found that people tended to say they preferred segregated infrastructure, and then they'd said something about the breakdown by gender. And you can see that the red bars are what studies that found that women's preferences are stronger, and the grey bars are where they didn't find any statistically significant differences. And the size of the bar is the study size, so you can see the bigger studies are tending to be more likely to find a difference. I mean, some of these studies, they're basically a room full of students and they're underpowered, so some of the smaller ones, I'm not surprised they didn't find differences. Actually, they're often a room full of male students, given they're often transport students in the US. But so you can see that kind of thing illustrates that there are differences in how different groups, the importance that different groups attach to having a comfortable cycling environment. And everybody, what we found from the review was that people generally wanted more comfortable, subjectively safe, separated cycling environments, but the women's preferences and probably the older people's preferences, the data was not so good there, were stronger. So from that I derived that we need inclusive design, that if we aim for what underrepresented groups want, that should suit everybody, because actually even the guy on the cover of Cycle Infrastructure Design would probably like for there not to be an HGV this close to his shoulder. He would probably like some more subjectively safe infrastructure as well. In terms of gender, we've kind of got stuck in a vicious circle. And another paper that I led found that between 2001 and 2011, so when cycling is going up, it's going up in some parts of the country. Across the country, it's not really going up much, but there's some places where it has gone up. So we looked at where cycling had gone up in the census, commuting cycling. Had inequalities decreased? And we found the answer was slightly depressingly no, that we hadn't succeeded in diversifying cycling in those places like London, Bristol and so on, where cycling had gone up. And it seems like having to cycle with busy or fast motor traffic that is particularly off-putting to many of these underrepresented groups, as is the image of a cyclist, but it's all connected. It's not like you can just change that image by putting up a nice picture with people with pink helmets on it. You know, it's actually all connected. You have to change the real environment. But the extra double whammy we found as part of the Propensity to Cycle Tool project found that women are less likely to cycle longer trips than men, which really matters, because what we've often done, we've maybe built a fast commuter route, which just means some blue paint on the road or something, and then signed a longer route through back streets. And so, oh, it's all right, the women and children can use the longer route through the back streets. But when you lengthen that distance, propensity to cycle falls for those routes. So it's kind of double whammy. You create one route that they feel is far too dangerous and another route that's going to be too long, which is interesting and a bit complicated. But it feels like we can get to a virtuous circle if we can just break out of this tradition that I hope we're starting to break out of. Because when you look at the Netherlands, you think, actually, well, women are more natural cyclists than men in terms of their roles, their responsibilities, the social construction of gender. Women tend to have lower car access. They tend to make shorter trips. They tend to make chained trips. Public transport can be more problematic. So there's a whole range of reasons why you might expect women to cycle more than men, but that doesn't happen here. And I think if, you know, getting the cycling environment right means that all those things, that image, the experience and so on, can work together. Cycling can be such a wonderful, sociable way of travelling that is really very inclusive, and yet we haven't managed to make it like that. And one of the things I think sometimes in debates around cycling research, infrastructure gets put in one place and culture in another place, but it is really all connected, because it's particularly important for underrepresented groups. It's often particularly important that cycling is seen as high priority, mainstream, important and valued. You know, if I'll give you an example from Cambridge. So in Cambridge, for people who, you know, academics who cycle in Cambridge, this poverty stigma that's still attached to cycling doesn't matter so much for them. Nobody is going to think that a professor on a bike is doing so because he or she is poor, right? But in Cambridge, I found that people who were doing more working class jobs, that were self-employed, for them that was more of a problem. And a builder said to me, you know, when I turn up at a job by bike, I sometimes wonder if they think, oh, he's obviously not doing very well because he's not in a van. So actually increasing the profile of cycling, creating that infrastructure that people look at and say, wow, this city really cares about cycling, that's particularly important for those groups because they're more affected by some of those stigmas, I think. There are hopeful small signs in relation to equality. This is one of the things I'm trying to do in my research, is piggyback on data that has been collected but that doesn't get properly written up. And I think that's a nice kind of cost-effective way of getting some stuff out there. So this is a Royal College Street observational study. Royal College Street has protected cycle space, and John Dales and his colleagues at Urban Movement collected some data on who cycled there compared to some parallel routes that didn't have cycle tracks. And we found that these things were statistically significant. The differences don't look that big, and I think, you know, it's only one street. You can't, you know, a whole network, a whole thing needs to change. But we were getting 25% women on those other roads, and we were getting 33% women on Royal College Street, which, you know, it's still not what you would like, but it's better. More diversity in terms of the clothing that people were wearing. John and his colleagues were out there looking at, are they wearing sporty clothing, tick and cross? And a higher proportion of over 60s, but still pitifully small, really. But, you know, you can see that where infrastructure is changing, slowly this is changing. It's going to be a long haul, but there is change starting to happen, I think. Some current challenges, maybe. So just to finish with this, that the safety focus is problematic. I recently did some research trying to look at risk across in different London boroughs and trying to look control by the amount of cycling. So not just look at numbers, but what is your risk per cycle trip in different London boroughs. And the riskiest were many outer London boroughs where hardly anyone cycles. So inner London is not great, but outer London is a lot worse. But because you don't get that many deaths there, because so few people are cycling, it doesn't get on the agenda in the way that Lambeth Bridge does. You know, it's seen that many of those junctions, frankly, if we get an upsurge in cycling in Harrow and Croydon, we will have deaths there. But we've not seen deaths there yet because people are not cycling there. So it's also making comfort and experience visible so that it matters for people to be comfortable while cycling. And it's kind of harder sell than it matters for people not to die. But, you know, if you want people to cycle, they have to be comfortable and happy. Getting further change in a multimodal city. London is very multimodal. It's not like some parts of the UK where it's basically the car or nothing. Obviously, it's a very good thing, but it's also challenging. There's big fights over road space, and people. There needs to be alliances. There need to be connections with disability groups, in particular, which is challenging because disabled people have been disproportionately excluded from cycling. Diversification is happening only slowly. Uptake of cycling is starting to get more diverse, but it's only happening slowly, which is maybe not surprising, but that is happening slowly. And as I was talking in a meeting this morning at TfL about freight, you know, freight and servicing is seen as essential trips. Well, actually, if all those white vans are going to stay on the road, there's going to be really limited scope for creating more space for walking and cycling. We have to, you know, we've got a lot of challenges in London, but I'm optimistic because change happens when you can't carry on doing things in the old way. It doesn't happen because people think, oh, it'd be lovely to have more cycling. It happens because, oh no, we're going to get 1.5 million people, and if they all drive, we will, nobody's going anywhere. So you have to overcome these challenges. Most of the UK, things are pretty bleak. I've done interviews where people have told me we don't have a transport planning function anymore. Everyone's been sacked and we don't know anything about transport planning. That's really depressing. And also what will happen in London. London has so much potential. Are we just going to stand still and not change and things get worse? Or are we actually going to make some radical change? So, yeah, that's right. I'll finish there then.
Thank you very much. So, anybody want to start us off with comments or questions? Yeah.
Since I intervened earlier, I was one of the people who organised Velo City back in '83, I think it was. I'm ashamed of those posters that the GLC put up. I can't remember them, but there are many things I can't remember. We really did worry about the risk factor of cycling because it was what we saw as one of the deterrents. I can remember two things that relate to what you're saying. Before Ken Livingstone took over the GLC back in '82, there was a Conservative administration, and they are on record, because I filmed them for the BBC, saying we don't put in cycle facilities anywhere in London because if we did, it would encourage people to cycle. And if they had accidents, it would then be our fault. And that's on record. So that was one great memory. The other was, you asked how the Netherlanders, the people from the Netherlands, looked at our attitude to cycling. We used to go to the Netherlands regularly to see, just to luxuriate in cycle lane. And we used to turn up with our fluorescent bands on, which we wore in London to try and live. They thought it was a political thing. And they sort of were very, they admired us for our political nous, that we were wearing these amazing things. In the end, we had to explain, no, actually, we just buy them in bike shops to try and stay alive. My final thought, because it brings back so many memories, but a few days ago, going to collect my newspaper, there was this whole load of guys from TfL doing counts. And I sort of went up and said, oh, what are you doing? And the bloke said, well, I'm counting the traffic for TfL. I'm doing the cars, but my mate over there, poor bugger, he's got to do the bicycles. And it has changed dramatically. And then I think the most encouraging thing is the amount of private car journeys is going down. But we've still got a long way to go, but, you know, thanks. Very interesting.
Thank you very much. I mean, yeah, the TfL, the analytical work they're doing at TfL, I mean, I was just talking to them just before I came here about some of the cycling modelling they're doing, some of that they're really pushing things forward. I wish they were shared it a bit more, but they're doing really great stuff, and that's what the counts, you know, part of those.
That's what you felt.
Okay, you talked about the fight over road space. Can you say a little bit about what's the view within TfL and generally about places like the Embankment and Blackfriars Bridge Road, where that has been reallocated, and the taxi drivers in particular were very against it? Is it seen now as successful?
I think there is not the view within TfL. I think there's kind of a lot of different departments that are all... I was recently told that a claim had been made that everybody was now harmonious and they were all agreed. I said, can they come and sort out my university next, please? I think there's different lobbying groups, and TfL is in different... There are different directorates, and there are people lobbying for different modes, and it is... So I think the view varies, but they have done some research looking at the capacity, the people capacity that those routes have now, and that has gone up. So it's partly getting those concepts changed, which is interesting, that traditionally capacity means capacity for motorised traffic, but actually the point of transport is not to move metal boxes around, really. It's kind of to get into where people can do what they need to do and get what they need to get. So they have done some work around that. I wouldn't say that there is one view within TfL, but I think, and they did stand up and Daniels, I can't remember, and said at the Transport Committee that they defended those schemes. They said maybe we could have phased the construction better. I mean, there's a lot of construction going in London the whole time, but they defended the schemes. So, you know, I'm hopeful, but I think there are different views in TfL that people lobby for different things all the time.
So, my question is about governance, the fact that you even have TfL here in London. In Australia, where I'm from, in Sydney, we have like, a lot of local government areas, and we don't have one over like overarching governance structure for the entire city. How important do you think having like Greater London Authority and TfL is just for getting this change?
That's interesting, because I remember it is, people do see TfL quite, from cycling people, see TfL quite positively in some regards for cycling now. And I remember one engineer in TfL saying to me, you know, don't forget, not that long ago, we were the bad guys. I think the arguments, because I've recently done a survey on barriers to investing in cycling, and one of the things that a lot of people have said is that level of, that devolution but control at the same time is quite important. And I don't know, you know, That's their view. I don't know necessarily how correct it is, but it certainly seems in this country some of those places outside the big urban centres have really found it very difficult to do anything for cycling at all. And some of those places, the cycling potential is actually relatively high because you have a lot of short trips. And really, some of those places, you just need to treat the north, south and east, west route through that town. Whereas in London, okay, we've done some stuff, but most of London still has a long way to go. Mm. So... I think the sheer size of London, the fact that there were those numbers of fatalities and serious injuries that got that media attention, which you don't have in other parts of the UK, was also important, though, too. So I don't know. It's difficult. So it probably depends what you're talking about as well, because some sort of smaller neighbourhood-based schemes, doing that on a bottom-up level can be quite effective. So controlled parking zones, well, not a cycling example, a nice example of that in London, that they're put in at a borough level. They're nothing to do with TfL, but what you find is that you put them in for one street, the next street, somebody goes, oh, all these people are parking in my street, and then it just kind of spreads and spreads. And if we can get that going for some walking and cycling stuff, that could also be very powerful, but it doesn't sort out your big roads.
I don't know, could you speak to, like, kind of the concepts, like, thoughts of permeability, because there's the quiet ways and the mini Hollands and grids and all those that have kind of been chopped down, to use a bit, like, and like the quiet ways have particularly been criticized since their implementation because the boroughs aren't, like, they're not stopping the roads and they're not, like, so the quiet ways is, rather than being a quiet way, it's a quiet way, not. I don't know if you could speak to that. It's like,
I think one problem, well, there's a number of problems. One problem is political will, and that it's still very hard, even in somewhere like London, where most households don't have a car, even in areas, like where I live, where having a car is not the norm at all. It's still hard to do many of those things. It's still seen interfering with parking. Andrew Gilligan referred to parking as the third rail, touch it and you die. It's still seen as very difficult. And local councillors, well, some of these groups have been quite effective at a, you know, GLA, TfL level, then local councillors often hear from people who are annoyed that they won't be able to drive down a particular street, or they won't be able to, they think they won't be able to park somewhere they used to park. So it's really hard to overcome those things. There's also a data problem, though, as well, which is what I'm what I'm trying to work on at the moment, which is that, one, we don't have good data on quality of the cycling environment, and we don't, you know, highway level of service is something that's quite simple and you could map it across the strategic road network, but we don't have something comparable for cycling. We really need that, I think. Then you could look at an area and sort of say, no, this bit of quiet, whatever, this route is not suitable for an 8-year-old, whatever your criterion is, a simple criterion. You can look across the whole network. Is it possible for someone with an 8-year-old to get from here to here? No, then something needs to change if this is a priority route for cycling. Plus more integrated planning as well, that still we have a problem. TfL's thinking around roads and streets has really moved forward, and you now have, they talk about movement and place. The place function is acknowledged, but movement is still seen often in terms of motor vehicle movement. And if we also see the cycle movement, or the cycle movement we want to get, and the pedestrian movement through those streets is important, maybe they can be more easily prioritised. But it's a common problem in transport, though, as well, that you see recently the Tavistock Place scheme. There was I was at the council meeting where that was discussed, and a member of some residents group that had set up to oppose it basically said, we shouldn't listen to the views of those people who are just passing through. So people who were just commuting, you know, I mean, there were injuries on that stretch that didn't need to happen, but it still becomes, so it's very difficult what becomes strategic, what becomes something beyond the street. Yeah.
I have more of a broad question about your work. One of the things that's come through from this talk is how interdisciplinary it is, and you're bringing lots of strategies, and I just wonder whether or not, as an academic, you found it challenging to get funding and to bring all of these different bits together to get the whole picture that you have.
Well, I just had a grant application turned down, so. But some are successful. It sort of crosses over different areas, but sometimes I guess I sort of see potential for. I try and not be ground down by things being turned down, and I had something turned down by SRC. I managed to persuade TfL to, but unfortunately they only put in less money than I would have got from SRC. I got the Near Miss project funded by the AHRC, which was not a funder I'd considered at all. But there are often angles that you can use when your work's quite interdisciplinary, I think, and some certainly. The sense I get from peer reviews is that some people really like work on cycling, some people really hate it. So you know, depends who you get as well. It can be. I've ended up with a lot of small grants often, and trying to do things sort of using other people's data. But I mean, it would be lovely to have £1 million grant, but it's good to use things. I think we judge things too much by how much we spend on them. We should actually maybe look a bit more in academia and, okay, that person had £20,000, they produced 5 papers and they had this policy impact and did this, actually made us better than the £200,000 grant that didn't get any of those things.
Can I just ask, just on that, your disciplinary background, I was kind of wondering, whether you were a sociologist or a geographer or something else.
Qualitative sociology. I don't have a transport background, so it's been quite an interesting journey. That's a whole other story itself, going from qualitative sociology to transport research. So yeah.
Okay, thanks. Oh my. I'm going to go over here first. Okay, and then back, and then Deborah.
I was just wondering if you happen to have a sense of the impact of bike share on this picture, and whether the uptake in cycling has been sort of as a result of bike share in some way, or not related. What would the percentage say?
Bike share in London, it's a pretty small proportion of cycle trips. It's also not taking many trips away from the car, as you would expect with London being, travel in London being as it is. However, I think it's really important culturally. I think for one thing, it makes cycling a public transport mode, which is interesting in itself in breaking down this individualisation. And it also potentially leads to a wider range of people cycling, which can in itself, Anna Goodman, who does a load of amazing work, did a study looking at people who were using hire bikes versus people who are using standard bikes, and found that you got a greater diversity of clothing and so on. You got it provided a different image of people cycling. I think that is important. It's not the numbers or the trips shifted from the car, but it's the image and the public transport issue. Mm-hmm. They should make it free for people who have a freedom pass, though, I think.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested in this issue of socialised risk versus individualised risk, and so when you get things like train infrastructure where the risk is very much perceived to be communal, we kind of design and invest in it in a different way than other modes like driving. But then with cycling infrastructure, there's, like you said, the culture is very much about risk is individualized. But then there's this funny double-edged sword. So where some cycling infrastructure feels as if it's designed for vulnerable cyclists, it's very risky, so we have to be very, very protective and design it in a very partitioned off way. Conversely, some cycling infrastructure is very much like the blue line on the road thing. So have you seen any change in the last 5 or 10 years in the policy planning approach to how risk is managed for cycling infrastructure?
There has been a shift from the blue paint to the more protected, more separated space. And there's been, I think there's a greater understanding when I see... there's a thing called cycling level of service, which is supposed to be used to assess lots of schemes, isn't used as much as it should be. But when the guy who led on developing that, specifically put in subjective experience, he said that's really important. We don't just want to look at fatality, we want to look at whether something makes people feel safe. So I think there is a shift towards seeing that as important, and also a shift towards taking things like near misses into account. So the police services, but also potentially in planning. So I think there has been a shift. I mean, it's within the context of contested road space. Often, trade-offs are sometimes unsatisfactory. So I'm thinking of signal phasing, for instance. But I think there has been a shift whereby it's it's seen as more the transport authority's responsibility to provide people with space that gives them some protection from motor traffic. Doesn't make sense.
I have a question about tribalism in cycling and whether there's anything that we can learn from European cycling models. So there's obviously an issue with tribalism in London in particular. You're either a roadie or a fixie trendy or a leisure cyclist. And perhaps the fact that those groups don't necessarily cross over at all. You're either doing one or the other, but you might not necessarily be a road cyclist and then commute in jeans and t-shirts. Whereas in other countries, do you find that people who cycle for leisure, perhaps for short journeys, then do sport on perhaps a different type of bike, and that there's a real differentiation between the types of journeys people are making?
Can
that be imported here to perhaps enhance what happens here?
I think importing that here is part of, you know, it's about changing a whole range of things and getting into that different environment, infrastructure, culture, policy, and so on. So I think that's where we want to get to, but it's going to be challenging to get there, because to some extent, and planners will say that, have said, oh, you know, we've put in this lovely bit of protected track and the cyclists are still behaving badly. It's like, okay, well, they're meant to go on this protected track and then they're meant to go into this 30 miles an hour one-way rover, they're jostling with three lanes of motor traffic, and you wonder why they're a bit uptight. But, you know, we've still got a long way to go. I think somewhere like the Netherlands, you see a really quite clear differentiation between sports cycling and other types of cycling. Not necessarily leisure commuting and so on, but certainly sports cycling. That is when you'll see the Dutch cyclists in their bright outfits and their helmets and, you know, doing a very different type of cycling. And it's not seen as, you know, a transport or leisure. It's something that's very different.
Do those people also have a city bike that they sort of mooch to the pub or the shops on separately?
Probably, yes. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and it's fine to do both, but it's part of the thing. In this country, they kind of got conflated on the cycling is seen as a kind of extreme sport, and it then, yeah. Mm. But.
Yeah, Alistair.
Thanks. I had two questions, if that's okay. So the first is methodological. I just wondered, I really like the documents you shared earlier, and I was wondering what you were doing with those. So if are you doing some sort of discourse analysis or looking at, the things from the 50s and then... Because I was interested in... So the individualisation of kind of the blame on the cyclist, and how some of the TfL posters recently have been kind of putting that back on motorists and saying you've got to look more for cyclists, and whether you're kind of doing an analysis of that, and how you're doing that kind of methodologically, if you are.
That would be really interesting. I mean, mostly those pictures, I've actually mainly used them in presentations and things. I haven't written it up properly. I went and collected loads of stuff. It was when I was working on a lot of different things. I just didn't have time to write it up. But maybe that will be something that I can look at when I've kind of finished my current stack of half-finished papers, because I am on sabbatical.
So you'd probably definitely use that as an example for a teacher if you did. So I'd encourage it. And so my second question, sorry, is... That's a very, very selfish reason. The second one was, I was just interested in the pollution stuff at the moment. And I just wondered if you're noticing in your liaison with TfL, if there's a shift towards actually motorists becoming these kind of people who should take responsibility for the health risks to other kind of... Because it feels like there's this sudden... I know it's been going for a while, but suddenly it's having some traction. Mm. And if that's something you're noticing...
Yeah, I think it's early days for that, because people don't really make the connection, do they? I mean, you know, obviously none of us want to make the connection between, you know, kind of throwing something in the rubbish bin, having a flight, or whatever, and the kind of outcomes of that. So people don't want to make a connection between them driving somewhere and the fact that someone's kids gets asthma. People don't want to make that connection, so it has to be made to them, and that's something that politicians who don't like to appear unpopular are a bit nervous about. But I think potentially things are changing, as long as it becomes seen as not something that you can have a technological fix to, and therefore we can all wait until drivers all have electric cars. It was interesting, I was talking to a guy called Frank Kelly, Professor Frank Kelly at King's College. He's one of the experts in air pollution. It's quite interesting, it's a room for people. He was the expert on air pollution. There were loads of other people going, oh, when we have electric cars, I'll be fine. He's like, no, it won't be fine, because 50% of the emissions come and not tailpipe emissions, so you're only solving half your problem, and it'll take ages anyway. And everybody was like, wow, I thought you would say electric vehicles were the answer. And he was like, no, you need mode shift. So as long as it's... If it's seen in those terms, then...
Yeah. If I could speak to that, I just know this because I'm busy doing like a policy advice capstone project with TfL about car usage.
Oh, okay.
So we had them come in and brief us about, and for them a lot of the problem definition is like a bit undefined about whether or not they're targeting polluting cars or cars in general in terms of like congestion terms. And it's kind of like they've got the diesel scrappage and they've got the electric vehicle kind of initiatives and stuff like that. And it's they seem to be kind of be balancing that and taking that angle whilst at the same time being like, well, maybe the problem's not cars. And and it seems a lot less of the modal shift. It's kind of more working within people like cars. How do we make them liking cars less of an issue rather than saying, like, let's stop people liking cars so much?
Mm. That's a shame. I mean, electric vehicles are part of the solution, but,
Do you know the proportion of car ownership? Like, what proportion of households actually have cars in London?
It's a minority in London. I mean,
it's
I could look at the borough figures. So in my borough, which is Hackney, then it's something like 66, 67% don't have a car. Households don't have a car. So it's different in some matters.
So in that sense, you know, because I read what I got, one of the things I got from your presentation was about that kind of... when it's kind of personally meaningful, you know, the journalists got onto it when they thought, oh, right, you know, I'm cycling, or my friend's cycling, and my colleagues are cycling and getting injured. And when it's kind of personal, you know, and then we say, oh, right, this is an issue. And I think we feel like the air pollution thing is becoming like that. You know, so many people don't have cars. Then we have all the recordings outside our schools and the LSE saying we're killing ourselves by breathing, or we're not supposed to take exercise outside.
Oh, that's a classic individualisation, isn't it? Hey, stop breathing, go into the loo, stay inside. It's ridiculous. But by the way, as well, that even in a city like London, the health benefits you get from walking or cycling are going to outweigh the air pollution negatives. But it's just, yeah.
One question.
Okay. Sorry, I tell you what, I've seen your hand up and then Nimesh after it. Okay.
Yeah, thanks. I like the points you're making about the cycle superhighways from a few years ago, or the original ones, where they were seen as a safety measure, but then in the cold light of day, it just seems like a few blobs of blue paint are probably going to wear off within a couple of years. But I thought you were sort of giving it a bit too much credit by saying that they were designed for people who didn't mind sharing the road with fast-moving traffic, because it just seemed like TfL were just scrimping on the measures, and by default, those were the sort of group of people who were going to use it, I suppose. The group of cyclists, I like the argument about the individual individualism versus societal approach. But could you just say a bit more about the local authority websites? You said that it was different. They took a different approach to other modes of transport for the public information. So I don't know. I didn't really get the point you were making about that.
Oh, sorry. In terms of that, yeah, the cycling websites tended to start with, "You should cycle. It's great. Hey, maybe you're a bit scared, but get some training, and it'll all be fine." Whereas the public transport websites would be like, this is a service we provide, here is how you can access it, not, they don't tend to be a lecture on why you should use public transport or information on how you can learn to use public transport. I mean, often the public transport in those places probably wasn't that good either, but it just seemed to be a different approach. And on the superhighways, I think, yeah, it is, to some extent, it's the default, but it's also what was the default, and it's the way that... A conversation with my mum is my reference point for, you know, why normal people don't cycle, and sort of being up in Preston and Lancashire, and it's, you know, some awful thing painted on the road. I say to my mum, oh, she's driving, I'm saying, oh, that's terrible, mum. And she's like, why is it terrible? I was like, mum, would you cycle then? She's like, well, of course I wouldn't. And, you know, this is someone who will cycle in a, you know, in a park or something, and maybe... It's just, it was never that kind of stuff. It is scrimping and it is badly designed, but, you know, presumably the people who put it in did think it had a purpose, and the default would be something like that. It's, I think, instructive. I know it's not, you know, it is a default, but it is a particular default, I guess.
Nimesh.
Yeah, this might be, I know this is a little off from your core research, you know, because it's focused on UK. But I was wondering, with regard to your last point, last slide on the inequalities, I mean, I was thinking a little bit about from the perspective of global inequalities, like how this, because if you really look at the low-income countries, for instance, not even, I mean, the emerging countries, I mean, there's still the kind of a discourse that you mentioned in the post-war period that you know, these big projects are considered, you know, they're prestigious, they're sexy. So at least from the country that I come from, Nepal, we have this discourse going on right now. We don't have a metro or underground in Nepal, so they're trying to build one. But there's also a competing discourse that although it's much smaller and then it's much invisible, that people are trying to say, you know, they're trying to turn the table around and saying, oh no, you know, we have to have like cycling lanes instead of having a big infrastructure metro project. But I mean, I see that coming out every now and then, but they are either like, you know, the policymakers, either, I mean, they are, these voices are shunned or they are silenced because, I mean, and their argument would be like, okay, you know, it's not, it won't cater to a big urbanizing city in the third world, which is a huge population. So I wonder if you have any, if there is any sort of a low income country which has a, you know, sort of has been exemplary, in, or what would smaller environmentalist or advocacy group could learn from the experience here from your work that.
It's very interesting, and it's kind of frustrating because, in a sense, many of those countries they could avoid going through the rapid motorization that we had them killing thousands
kind of
years.
Kind
of
thing that
lots of people use bikes, right?
Absolutely. It was even when I was growing up, I used to go to school in a bike. It used to be a 30 minutes ride. I went to school in a bike, but now it's like completely diminished. I mean, it's nothing. You don't see it. And so every now and then there will be this, you know, even I have some friends who try to revive this thing, but then it kind of disappears. So it's really frustrating.
There's some literature from middle-income countries anyway. There's quite a lot of literature from Latin America. There's also quite a bit of stuff from India. So there is stuff from different countries. Some of the cities in those countries as well have, because car driving is still in the minority, I mean, obviously they have motorised more than some other countries, but it's easier to make some of the social justice arguments, perhaps like Enrique Peña Loza sort of saying, you know, it's not a civilised country is not one where the poor have cars, you know, where everybody can get around by walking, cycling, and public transport, those kind of things. So yeah, there is some literature, but it's largely, the literature I'm aware of is largely from India and Latin America.
Let's
have two final comments, okay? Yeah.
I want to make a point about the iconography of cycles, because when we were campaigning back in the 80s, there were no cycle facilities in London. So the first pathetic little painted cycle on the road was no safety at all. It didn't, but it actually said for the first time cyclists exist. And we saw that as actually politically quite important. And even though they were rubbish cycle lanes and you know, they weren't much good. The fact that there were cycle logos appearing on the road and then cycle racks were being put up meant that we felt we were beginning to stop being invisible. And now with the superhighway north, south, east, west, you sort of think that's where we'd like to be everywhere. But so there was an iconographical thing about it, but not just cycle lanes. I'm sure you've come across that.
I'm kind of in two minds because some places, when I was doing the barriers to investing in cycling surveys, some places that have not had the funding and the political, you know, stuff that we've had in London, they would say that people, stakeholders from those areas, sort of said that those kind of things for their areas actually made it worse because nobody used them. Then people opposed cycling then went, ah, oh, look, you put all the stuff in and no cyclists are bothering to use it, we shouldn't spend any more money on cycling. And they're obviously in a different political and funding environment, but they, you know, in a sense, said that it could actually make it worse as well. I think in London, the poor first generation cycle superhighways did do something to encourage more people to cycle, even though they were poor. But
there was a film called GLC Cycling for London about 1982, which is on the internet, and it shows you what the cycling facilities look like then. And it's kind of shocking, really. If you've not seen it, you should.
I just wanted to know your opinions on how useful a political economy lens is at looking at this issue in terms of the growth in cycling perhaps being aligned with the professional, like new capital versus an old capital of your freight and trucking companies, and that sort of clash of capital. And then now with like Uber, there's also almost this internal clash in the new capital between
the Uber class, the Uber sort of group in that class, and the professionals who want to cycle into their finance jobs. How useful do you think that is as a sort of explanatory factor for the growth of cycling popularity?
I think it's interesting. I think it's maybe more as a... I worry that it kind of slides over the fact that a lot of cyclists are not going to finance jobs and not, you know, this is one particular aspect of cycling, and in London...
I sort of mean like upper middle class, green voting, you know, tech savvy, young, that sort of demographic, not just finance, but...
I know, but most cyclists are not. If you look, particularly if you look across the country here as a whole, there's not really that much socioeconomic variation in cycling. There's, I think C1 is slightly lower, that's what I found now. But there's not really the difference between, say, professionals and unskilled workers that you would expect from some of that rhetoric. I think it's more relevant in London and some discourse around cycling in London, but I sort of worry, I think... that planning can sort of play into that, and that if we, I mean, it's brilliant that we have better cycle superhighways that have gone in, hopefully will continue to go in, but we also need not just to think about good commuting routes to get people into the city, but people also need those routes. And it's an equity thing. I remember reading some quite interesting literature on buses and things like that. The buses often just go into the city centre, and yet people who, you know, need to get to different employment areas or need to buy food for a particular culture, they, you know, they are not served by those services. So I worry that, I think there is something there, but I would worry that we kind of think, oh, cyclists do, you know, this particular group, and we build for them, and really some of the gains, that group, you know, people like that can afford to drive, they're not as urgent need as the health benefits from cycling. It's, you know, some of the people who are not cycling, I think, is so important that they get those benefits. Right? But I do like this economy, though. I have a background in that too.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. A very stimulating.